what I see from personal experience is we'd go on a group ride and we'd roll a lot of stop signs, okay? But in a part of a big bunch, I actually feel safer doing that because it's hard to miss a big group of people. So we do some of these rides or some of these roads I would never go on. And there's a ride as an example that does a Thanksgiving Day ride on a road near my house that I would never go on a bike. Wow, what a day at the Vuelta, stage 11 just concluding, and we saw a completely different type of race. And we'll get into all that a little bit later, but a lot of decimation atop the long, gradual climbs, bad weather. It looked more like the Giro in May rather than the Vuelta in August. But we'll get all to that. We'll get to stage 10 recap. We'll do stage 11 recap. We'll go a little preview on the next few stages and what's coming up for the Vuelta for the weekend. But first, let's get to some news and articles, some interesting stuff from the world of cycling. There's some contentious things going on, some new drug pops that just came out, guys getting DQ'd. And, you know, I think we're going to bring someone on later this week and actually have a full discussion about some of the drug stuff, especially in this Masters. But right now, we're going to just throw it out there, talk about a few things, and then we'll get right into the race stuff. All right. First, just a little interesting thing. I'm sure you've heard of Chris Hoy. He is a Great Britain track writer, Sir Chris Hoy. Just recently, there was an article where he was interviewed for GQ in Great Britain, and Chris Hoy had to apologize for this article in which he said, quote, "Feel sorry for my meals," unquote. And that riders wearing professional team kits, quote, "look as ridiculous as an overweight football fan wearing the shirt of his favorite club for a pub 5-a-side game." Now, unquote. I don't understand all of that, being from Britain and speaking a different type of English than what I do. But I had to look up a few things. One is Mamil. I did not know that, but it's a middle-aged man in Lycra. Evidently, he basically was making fun of these men and saying that, you know, that wearing their kits out in places, and he was basically making fun of it. I'd never heard of the term Mamil, but I've definitely seen them in the wild. And they are a funny looking type. Personally, I don't try to do that. You know, we go for a ride. We end up going to a place, and if there's a bunch of you around, we'll get drinks and, you know, some food. But I'm not typically. I went for a ride last weekend, and we did a group ride. I'm in Coffee Republic, getting some stuff. There's a bunch of people around. It's not a big deal. Then I ended up going to the grocery store with my wife, and in front of us in line at Costco, there's a guy. He's wearing his cycling shorts, and he's got a sleeveless jersey on. And of course, my wife, who's used to this kind of stuff, you know, she's laughing about it and making fun. These people should be made fun of. And honestly, to have Chris Hoy have to apologize is a little lame. I mean, come on. He says, look, I'm overweight myself. I shouldn't be making these comments. You know, he's a big guy. He does it in terms of weight as stone, 8 stone. I'm not familiar with. I know what that means. I didn't do the conversion. He said he's 10 stone. I don't know what that converts out to. Probably some sort of kilograms, which I have to transfer back into pounds because that's how I deal with things. Why don't you just use hands? You know, isn't that what they say about a horse is, you know, 5 hands or 10 hands or whatever it is? I guess maybe that's height. All right, I digress. The next big thing we have going on is Cale Liljegrand tested positive. This is a 40-year-old rider from Team Surf City. He tested positive for 7 different drugs after the Dana Point Grand Prix, which he won in May 2017. I do remember something, because then the articles that are basically everyone's posting this on Facebook and ripping him up. This is a second offense. He got an 8-year suspension rather than a lifetime suspension. We'll get into all that stuff. First thing I was interested in is the articles were talking about a former Rock Racing rider, well, which that was a team he rode with when he got popped the first time as a professional. But now he rides for Team Surf City. It's a team down in Southern California, a lot of Masters riders, a lot of crit guys that like to bang elbows. Not a big fan of their team, as I've raced against them several times. However, this news first came around, I think it was June. I'd seen stuff online, and then he indicated that, look, hey, the night before I took some things, I took some supplements I wasn't supposed to. It had nothing to do with cycling. It looks like it was maybe these, you know, I took a protein shake, and I put something in that was not quite perfect quality from the hemp manufacturer. Well, seven different drugs is not quite the same thing. So he obviously had an issue, and he's been delving into this quite a, you know, and then you read online also. So Surf City tries to make, hey, we're not part of this. I get it. That sucks for their team. But none of the news articles actually said it was Team Surf City, which I found to be kind of sorry. You know, that's who he rides for now. They decided to take on this ex-doper, bringing him on, and they should actually reap some of the consequences from that. And why put Rock Racing back in the news? You know, it's 10 years plus. Anyway, so this is Kaleo Grand's second offense. Like I said, he only got an 8-year suspension. USADA is the one that comes down with the suspension. They gave him 8 years rather than a full lifetime ban. And my thinking on this, and this is just me trying to read between the lines on some things, his first suspension was not, it was a non-analytical, or I have to look at how they phrase that again, but he never tested positive. They did it basically, so we'll go back to that. He was at Super Week, and he was worried actually that he was going to be popped for taking EPO. So he was a little stressed about it, and he told a soigneur about it. She then ends up reporting it. So at some point, they end up tying him to Joe Papp, who had been a guy that was basically supplying a lot of riders during the time. Joe Papp does. They end up getting some EPO that I think he had left behind at an apartment. And so they never got him a tested positive. So my thinking on that is, if you test positive, it's one thing. And maybe the way it is there, they can only do an 8-year suspension. That's why they did it. So, you know, look, when he's 48, he'll be back in the game, coming on strong. And, you know, the word is, I've seen this multiple times with him, where he's trying to fight people in the parking lots. He's a crit rider. He's a sprinter. He gets real, real hopped up. And I don't know if it has to do, you know, everyone wants to say it's roid rage of some sort. Perhaps it is. But anyway, we can get into that. There is an interesting connection between Leo Grand, Joe Papp, and Armstrong. And you can find this on the internet. There's multiple stories. There's a whole New York Times article from 2012 that basically said that Novitski, the guy that was going, the Fed that was doing the investigation, started basically with the Leo Grand, Joe Papp thing. And that led to kind of the Armstrong and bringing down Armstrong. So Leo Grand himself had something to do with Armstrong. And, you know, in the article, he kind of talks about how he feels some sort of contrition. Did he? I mean, it appears that he didn't. So we had another little thing I saw here that was of interest. So Contador, after stage 10, he made some comments about riding in the rain, where there was some rain on stage 10. He said, I don't know if the climbs of tomorrow are first category or earth category, because they are very hard. And all the water we had poured on us today affect the legs, leaving them very blown. And it is important to recover well. We have to have good draining massage, and we will see what we can do tomorrow. Now, I'm not sure that his whole analysis there is truly scientific about water on your legs and that they're feeling blown and bloated. But anyway, that's what he said. And you know what? He may have had a point, because there's some bad legs going up in stage 11 today. Okay, I saw this other report just this morning. It talked about cycling deaths on the rise. It talked about cycling deaths over the last several years have gone up to over 12%. Now, you're looking at numbers like the high 700s in a year to like 800 deaths in a year. And also the other interesting part was the average age of the cyclist dying has gone up as well. Looked at one story report of the actual report study itself, and that's all they talked about. They didn't really go into it. So my first thinking is, well, okay, if things are going up and more people are dying, 12% seems to be a high number. But yeah, if you're only going, you know, like 40, 50 deaths extra a year, well, that's never good. That is something to actually think about. Are the actual cycling, are more people on the road on their bikes actually up? So I actually pulled out the study, and I was able to see that one of the things they did mention there that is the actual adults biking to work in the U.S., just riding to work itself, not ones just actively riding, but just riding to work, has gone from 0.4% in 2005 to 0.6% in 2013. So that is an increase of people just doing biking to work. Now, 0.2% change isn't huge, but they didn't give a number of where they actually got that. But I'm assuming you're talking about millions of people as a data set. So millions of people, and you have a 0.2% increase. That's a much vast number. Matter of fact, that over number, the whole number, just sheer number in aggregate, is more than the 12% rise of the deaths. Now, okay, so what about it? They also attributed this to actually saying in the article that the answer was, well, that the reason for more of these wrecks is accidents between cars and bikes. It wasn't just bikes going down, but the two between each other. Cars not actually seeing the rider, and then the rider's assuming that the car is going to yield basically to them. So of course, then the answer in Bicycling Magazine that wrote this up was they needed more laws for this. Well, I'm not in favor of that, especially when you read the study and you attribute the deaths, as I said, to both sides. Now, I didn't break it down to what those actually were to see if the cyclists are more apt to think that the car is yielding. I mean, what I see from personal experience is we'd go on a group ride and we'd roll a lot of stop signs, okay? But in part of a big bunch, I actually feel safer doing that because it's hard to miss a big group of people. So we do some of these rides or some of these roads I would never go on. And there's a ride, as an example, that does a Thanksgiving Day ride on a road near my house that I would never go on a bike. But you can do it on a group ride because it's a Thanksgiving ride, mostly because there's like 200 cyclists. There's absolutely no shoulder. It's very dangerous, but you get a whole group. The cars really have no choice. They see you. So when I'm riding solo, sometimes, you know, I don't actually feel as safe in some of those areas. So therefore, you know, the problem is I see is people riding and they're treating traffic similar to how they do on group rides. You know, maybe they're still rolling signs. They're assuming the cars are. I feel like when you're riding solo, you have to be, first of all, if you're going to pick a fight with a bully, picking the one with the car is always going to be a losing battle. So why even engage in it? So I guess my point is, when we're out there all by ourselves and you're in small groups, you know, obey the law as good as you can that's already in existence. You know, try to always be careful and mindful that that car is likely not going to yield and be attentive for it. Although I've found lately some of my biggest problems are I go to a four-way stop or some of these others and the cars are there before me and they're trying to have me go in front of them. And I'm like, look, I'll obey the rules, you'll obey the rules, and we'll be set. We'll be perfectly fine. So I think part of it is they've become conditioned as well to assuming some cyclists are running stuff. So, you know, as a cyclist, let's just do our part. We don't need more laws. I mean, just obey the ones that are out there and we should be fine. Off the soapbox for now, let's go to stage 10. Caravaca de la Cruz to El Pozo Alimentacion. I'm sure I nailed that one. 164 kilometers. This was yesterday. They had a Cat 3 climb that connected into a Cat 1 with real no distinction between the two. And we're going to see that actually, I believe it's tomorrow or the next day, like Thursday or Friday, we're going to have a similar situation. Or maybe it's over the weekend. We'll get to that in a little bit. But anyway, like one Cat 2 climb, maybe this whole one that they had yesterday. So as I predicted in the previous stage 11, the GHC guys actually wouldn't make the mistake of taking, they wouldn't take much time on this. Someone may lose time, but we didn't really see that either. Nibbly did try to go over the first KOM. He tacked right near the top, and then he tried to push it on this long descent. But ultimately, he didn't get away, and the group actually stayed together. Well, it stayed together except for Nico Roach, who ended up pipping about 30 seconds at the end, coming up all the way to second place, tied with Chavez. That Nibbly attack downhill kind of reminded me of a few things. One, he's done this. He did that last year in the 2016 Giro, and it actually caused Kreiswijk, who was in the Giro pink jersey leading at the time, caused him to crash. He was trying to hang on, and ultimately he lost it and smacked into a big snow wall doing, you know, 35, 40 miles an hour, hurt himself pretty badly, and then the next few days wasn't able to really do much with that and ended up losing the overall. We've also had a guy, El Falco, it's Paolo Salvadelli. He was able in the 2005 Giro, chasing down Gilberto Simoni, descending like a crazy man down the Finestre, and finally up the final ascent to Siestre, he was able to hang on to him. Salvadelli, he was known as just a tremendous descender, and I think he won the Giro twice, and a lot of those was being able to do exactly that, hang on to the last climb by doing some really daring descents. Sean Kelly, he did a look this one up on YouTube. It's always one that's great to do. It's 1992 Milan San Remo, chasing down Moreno Argentine, crested the Poggio, 10, 15, somewhere around there, 8, 10 seconds behind Argentine, and just blasted the final descent, which is not too long, and then was able to win at the end. Like I said, check that one out on YouTube. I've referenced this a few times, but Daniel Freeb wrote a book, The Cannibal, and it's all about Eddie Merckx, as you might know by the title. And what I got from there is Eddie, I didn't know this previously, but Eddie Merckx was actually quite the man of doing exactly what Nibbly was doing, which was he would attack close to the summit and then just do daring descents. And especially later on in his career when he started to wane a little bit, this was really a thing he did in fashion. As a matter of fact, the 1971 tour, I looked this back up in the book last night, and Luis Ocaña was leading the tour. It's some interesting things how you'd have the time gaps there. At one point, Ocaña's leading like over 7-8 minutes, then, you know, Merckx ends up taking 2-3 minutes back in a stage, but they come to one stage and Eddie Merckx basically attacked over. Ocaña's hanging on his wheel. He'd already been kind of just mentally done in with Merckx and some of the stuff out off the race, and he's trying to follow him, and they both slide out. Ocaña really goes down hard, and Merckx remounts and ends up taking off, and Ocaña tries to get back on, and then basically he just sits up and gets a helicopter. So and quits the race. So there's all kinds of talk then about, hey, well, you know, how bad was he hurt? Maybe it's a concussion, broke his spine. And as it ended up being, it was really not much. And then that led a bunch of people to basically say, hey, maybe he could have continued on. And then the comments, of course, are, well, you know, Eddie Merckx would, you know, get punched in the kidney and he still continues on. This is not a guy that would have done that. So the consensus there is that Ocaña pretty much mentally had cracked rather than physically. And even though he was one of those guys that they said that was the first guy to not be afraid of Eddie Merckx, but evidently just got to him a little mentally. Anyway, it kind of reminded me of that. You know, Nibali's taken this on himself, and we'll see in stage 11 that he does try to do some attacking up off the front for once, but he just doesn't have anything. He's not really able to get away. Back to the head of the race on stage 10, you had Matteo Trentin of Quickstep. He ended up winning the stage over another sprinter type, JJ Rojas of Movistar. They went over that final climb, and Trentin was, for a sprinter who's in the green jersey or the sprinter's jersey right now, he went over that, just flew, and then he just hung on to Rojas coming down. Rojas, I guess, a local boy, and he knew that descent. You look at the descent, they couldn't really follow it with the motorbikes. They were pretty much showing it from above, and it was the twistiest thing I've ever seen. Pretty dramatic, and you know, the main GC guys all ended up hanging together. Like I said, Roach, who poached a little bit of time. General classification after stage 10, Chris Froome in the lead still. Chavez, 36 seconds back. Roach, also at 36 seconds, tied for second. Vincenzo Nibali at minute 17, and Van Garderen at 127. All right, so we have stage 11. That's today, Lorca to Calar Alto. Tried to look up a few things. The town of Lorca is in the Murcia region of Spain, and its main economy is based on agriculture and stock breeding, specifically pigs and brown cows. So this town is very dependent on exports of pork and other textiles. I saw a tweet online from one of the Euro reporters there that he was all in a Twitter, so to speak. He was all twisted up over, I think, the start being at some sort of pork facility, and he talked about some unethical issues. So I don't know if they were doing, I couldn't figure out what he was complaining about, but he was all up in arms. Once again, you can have, you know, past dopers on the tour. You can have a team that's shady with their connections, Bahrain, Merida. And yet, you know, you start it from some place that has wonderful, yummy pork, and that seems to be the most tragic thing on tour. Granted, maybe they've had, you know, some sort of serial killer living in the Merckx there in the midst, and I just don't know about it. So, you know, maybe it's on me for not doing enough research. All right, the stage today ended at this observatory, big high atop above tree line. So you just know it's going to be tough. Any big mountain with an observatory above tree line is typically a climb that's just going to be nasty, and usually it's less humid. You know, that they need those at places. Mount Hamilton, as an example, up for in San Jose, you just tip over the side of the hill. I have in-laws that live over there, and they have, you know, really dim street lights or no street lights at all. It's also that this observatory can be peak and see the mountain, see the sky as it's supposed to without any interference from light. They're usually, you know, barren mountains, and usually in a spot where you're going to have less humidity. Well, today was a lot of humidity, rain actually. Anyway, you think of the mountains like Mont Ventoux, Mount Washington, Mount Hamilton. Those are all the, you know, the observatory type things, and that's exactly how this climb was. It had a Cat 1 climb, once again, connected with just a descent that came off the first one, and then the damage starts right at the 50 kilometers to go. This is where the observatory just looms over the mountain of this, like I said, above tree line, part of this Andalusia mountain chain in Spain. So today we had the field right from the start. There's just bad weather. They've been having heat waves. They're basically through there in Spain. Today it was really cold. I think they said 8 degrees Celsius, around 40, 45. at the summit. There was wind. As I said, there was a lot of rain. So it's not what you would expect at this time of year. And, you know, some of these riders, it's going to be a massive change to their system, which I think you may see today. As far as today's actual results may, you know, you come out of this with some people did advance themselves nicely, but I think you saw more damage, possibly due, I don't know, was the terrain just as much as the weather? It could be. So we had a short break, guys off the front. There was about seven of them. The only one of real note was Roman Bardet, which you should have seen coming from yesterday when he sat up and lost himself about 14 minutes coming in. So as the climb starts, Bardet kind of goes to the front and he's holding himself. I don't remember the guy who came with him, but out of the pack, you saw Simon Yates of Orica Scott. And he started making his move up to Roman Bardet. Well, this has been after Orica Scott team had actually been on the front, kind of just shelling everyone out, or at least stringing them along. Yates was also another person that lost about 14 minutes yesterday, and he's been losing time. So I thought maybe he's going to try to set up for Chavez. So he attacks, he bridges up to Bardet, and then he had Atapuma come out of the field as well. So you had Bardet, Atapuma, and Yates. Now this climb, this was all outside of 14, 15 kilometers. So they started out quite a ways out, and it was already getting a little pitchy. But just inside the 14 to go, Bardet starts to grimace. Yates either sits up or, you know, you can tell at that point, I didn't know what he was doing. In hindsight, it looked like he was just blowing up. I thought maybe he was going to wait for Chavez to come out of the field. But even then, you know, you look at 14K, it's a little too much to really be putting the hammer down. So Bardet and Atapuma are kind of dangling. They're about 225 out in front of Froome. And then that's when you start seeing the overall complexion of the race, the GC field, just kind of come into fore. You had the Bahrain Merida team starts coming to the front. They're kind of swapping off between the Sky field. And then next thing you know, we're at 12K to go. And Bardet about comes unhinged trying to sweep off of Atapuma. This is when the bad situation happens where De La Cruz of the Quickstep team gets a flat and he has a wheel change. So right as he has a wheel change, he starts making his way back up to the group. And I think it's about 10 to go. And just as he's trying to almost make connection, actually it's 11K. 11K, Contador ramps up and just attacks. So De La Cruz actually doesn't quite make connection right when Contador attacks. Nibali goes with him, but it spits out Roach. Like I said, De La Cruz wasn't quite there. And then it just starts to shred everyone. TJ, Woods, Aru, along with Chavez and Yates. Froome just has two teammates left. Nibali and Contador actually look like teammates as they're kind of going off the front. Nibali keeps looking back to see if Contador is going to be there. And then the race is just on. So from 10K to go, you have pretty much the situation. We have Zakarin, Kelderman. You have Miguel Angel Angel Lopez of Astana up front, along with Froome, Nieve, Nibali, Contador. And then from there on out, you start having different groups. You know, Aru's on there, Woods is out there. You don't see TJ just explodes dramatically, spectacularly as the race. You know, this is 10K out. So from 10K, you start having these separate groups and probably some guys going solo. Chavez, he doesn't appear to be good. He imploded as well. Oh, Nibali also had a teammate, Pilazotti, up there. And Pilazotti would come up, pull for him. And then you would have Nieve. And I think Wout Poels was still in that front group. The break is caught. Like I said, they had already been caught. So you have this full group now. The Froome group is out in the front. And then they get some weird tactics coming in the last little bit where it looks like Nibali kind of just takes off, who allows his teammate, actually, Pilazotti, to pull in the front. And while his teammate is pulling on the front, Nibali is drifting back like he wants to get behind everybody. As that's happening, then Nieve goes up to Pilazotti, and then Nieve himself kind of attacks. But the only ones going are kind of lesser knowns. It's not Froome. Froome had kind of been sitting on the back. It wasn't Contador, and it wasn't Nibali. And so it creates a small separation between, you know, like Nieve, Zakarin, I believe, and kind of the main three contenders, which I would call them, which would be Nibali, Contador, and Froome. Then suddenly Nibali, when there's a gap there, he boom, just attacks out. And at this point, you've got to see, you know, what's going to happen, because we're near 2K to go. Nibali counterattacks, and Froome just kind of slowly makes his way. Next thing you know, he hits the turbo, and it's about 1.5K, and boom, Froome is up front. So now we have Froome, Lopez, Nibbly, and Kelderman's weaving in and out. And then you have inside the 1K, Superman Lopez. He just decides to, I'm taking it on while Froome and Nibbly just kind of counter off of each other and look around. Miguel Angel Lopez of Astana, he ends up taking the win. And then he's followed about 17 seconds later by Froome, Nibbly, and Kelderman. There is some time bonuses there, so Froome was able to grab that as well. Superman is Angel Lopez's nickname. He just, but yet when he crossed the line, evidently he's Catholic, but he crossed himself. He pointed up to the sky. I think with this modest salute, I'm assuming his nickname Superman is a self-assigned one because he just has somewhat of humility. Otherwise, you might see him, you know, trying to do some stupid thing like the peacock of Messina. All right, so he gets a well-deserved win. Colombian rider from Astana. Froome, Nibbly, and Kelderman come in next. And then you start having dribs and drabs. Contador, 31 seconds. He's 11 seconds behind Froome. There's a time bonus involved there. De La Cruz. De La Cruz has been looking good. He, even though he got the flat, he starts going from group to group and kind of going through them, where else you just saw guys like kind of hanging on. I suspect that if he had had the opportunity to stay with the group and not have that flat, he would have been in that front section and losing, you know, probably around the 31 seconds. But he, as it was, he only lost a minute 11 to the winner. Then he had Rue and Kruiswijk coming in at 133, Chavez at 205. And then you had TJ, 336 behind Lopez, and Roach at 417. So the general classification at this point, Froome is in the lead. Nibbly has moved up into second at 119. Chavez at 233, De La Cruz at 236 in fourth, Kelderman 237 at fifth, Zacharin 238 sixth. Then you have Aru, Woods at 3 minutes, Contador at 355, Lopez, today's winner, at 411, and then 445, you have Roach and TJ at 11 and 12. All right, so some of my thoughts here. Froome is just going to be tough to beat. Today was an issue where they had to deal with the weather. The weather might have split the field just as much as the terrain itself. I think Contador is looking very strong, but I'm not sure he's able to make the podium. I mean, he's, what, ninth place? And as Nibbly and Kelderman aren't looking any worse, so he's got to actually get in front of them and some others along the way. Further, Zacharin and De La Cruz are also in the mix. And like I said, De La Cruz actually, for having a bad result, comparatively to on the day, he actually looked one of the best riders out there. Woods and Aru are in the front in the as well in the GC, but they're looking a little more fragile. And then you had the Roach and TJ. I mean, they suffered mightily today. But, you know, I'm maybe going to give Roach and TJ and some of all these riders today is kind of a pass, right? They made it. Especially, let's take a look at TJ. Okay, he gets dropped at 10K to go. And all the groups I saw on the road, he was not with. So he was not with any of these stronger riders that he could have just kind of hung on to, gaining more valuable time. He likely was riding a lot of it on his own. So only to lose 3:30 on the stage winner and really just over 3 minutes on Froome of the day isn't horrible. And then you mix in any of this weather. He's known to have some days like this. I've seen it where I think it was a tour of Switzerland a few years ago, 2 years ago, perhaps. Just last year, I believe, where he was looking to be in the overall, has a horrible day in the weather. And he's like, I don't know what it is. My legs are locked up. Next day, it's bad weather again, but he ends up taking the win on a horrendous rain-soaked day. So you don't know what could be coming of any of these guys, not just him, but any of these. And matter of fact, it almost looked like Froome might be one of those that suffered through the weather again today. You know, up near the top, there's a lot of headwind. So if you're not kind of which kind of nullifies climbing if you can stand someone's wheel. When you get popped off of that, it's almost even more accentuated. So like I said, he got TJ got popped off at 10K and then he didn't do so poorly being on his own. We'll see how that goes from here on out. All right, stage 12. This comes up tomorrow. It's a shorter stage at 160 kilometers. That's two categorized climbs. And the second one crests around 101 kilometers in. And so you have, what, just roughly 50 kilometers out. Then there's the second kilometer KOM at 140 and still 20K to the finish. So the distance is shorter, but I think you're going to see less fireworks from the GC. And I just don't think the stage profile or the routes will stir any of the guys to create a show, especially with the next few days coming up. So then you have Friday. It looks like it's just going to be a day for the sprinters. Saturday and Sunday. On these ones, I think the Vuelta did their marketing research and they saved their best TV viewing races for the weekend. This is the kind of thing that they've been doing and I do love it. Stage 14 is 175 kilometers. You got three categorized climbs. You got a Cat 3, a Cat 2, and then what's called an Especial category. This is like as a Tour de France, they do an orange category or uncategorized. And it's up the Sierra de la Pandera, and it's just under 2,000 meters in elevation. That's going to be a nasty one. Stage 15, the next day, is a more of a firecracker where it's 129 kilometers. It's got a Cat 1 at 57, and then it has a connecting Cat 1 to the Especial category from 96 to 129. That one, I couldn't even see that there was a difference between the Cat 1. It just is. It's a climb. And it says Cat 1, like halfway up the climb, and then it just goes on up. So I don't even know if there's a distinction between those two. Okay, so that'll be pretty brutal once again. And depending on the weather, we'll see how that one goes. I mean, if you have another cold day here, and then all of a sudden you go back to some heat, I mean, these drastic changes in the weather can actually really shake things up. Like I said, I didn't see Froome. Well, he didn't lose any time to any of the main guys at all. So he's still looking pretty good, as we said. Okay, so then we have, this is going to finish out on Sunday, the racing in the southern part of Spain in the Sierra Nevada mountain range. And then they have a rest day, and then they have a huge transfer all the way up to the north. And either transfer on the rest day or maybe the day before. But either way, they do a mass transfer, and that's where we see the last third of the race. They're going to do a 40K TT and then run through the mountains there with the Angerloo, finishing on a Saturday, which is that's like the queen stage maybe? It should be great to see. So lastly, Cannondale Dre Pack released a whole thing online about their crowdfunding and trying to get the basically fans involved. There's multiple tiers. You can check it out. We can put it up on Twitter. There's multiple tiers for if you want to invest anywhere from $25 up to several thousands, hundreds of thousands, I imagine. And then Caleb Fairley, he had been with the team as a cyclist. He's the Fairley Group, I think is what it is. He and his father, they're rider agents. And they have pledged to match up to $2 million. So, if you people put in some $50, $100 and then they match it and you end up getting, a few million out of this, that's $4 million. You never know what this team can do. And I don't think this is a sustainable plan for being able to support team, the crowdfunding, but it is an interesting way to keep them going. And one thing that Vodders has mentioned in this is by doing this, what you're actually showing is to any potential sponsor that there's one, a fan base, and two, a motivated fan base. I don't know. I'd like to have, I'm planning on having someone here talk to me, come on with our podcast to discuss, like I said, the drug doping masters thing and also put his point of view. I'm not going to say who it is, Kurt, I'm not going to say who it is. Come on and talk about the crowdfunding and the economics of cycling as well. Hope you have a good day, good rest of the week, and stay tuned for more action here on the Between Two Wheels podcast. Join us online, cycletyler@gmail.com, tyonki on Twitter. Look for our team website. We'll put all the links into the show podcast notes. Like us, make a comment. And with that, you have a good day.